Today is March 18th, 2020, and this is episode number, 526, I'm going to get it right, of the Apple Context Machine. That's a podcast for the Mac Observer. I'm Brian Chaffin, a veteran pro when it comes to sheltering in place. To get the full story on anything we cover in this podcast, you can visit macobserver.com/ACM. And if you'd like to comment on or question anything about the show, shoot us a note at macobserver.com/contextmachine. That'll actually take you to our Facebook group. And our sponsor this week is ExpressVPN. Later in the show, I'm going to tell you how to get 3 free months with them. It's cool, right? But for now, almost as cool, I'd like to welcome John Keat. No, also just as cool, John Keat.
I also like to note that I am the CEO and president of the Hermits Collective. So we'll welcome you aboard. So, glad at least two of us are not enjoying any change of lifestyle whatsoever.
Let's see. Social distancing, stay at home. Yeah, must be. Let me check my notes here. Yep, a day of the ends and why here in the Chaffin household and in the Keat household, huh? No, because I happen to know that you you go out to pick up food and bring it back to your house all the time.
What do you mean? What, like an animal? They bring it right to me.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Dude,
it's so bad in New York that the groceries, they don't only deliver to the building. They not only go past the doorman will let them on up, right? They don't only not bring it to your door. They bring it to your counter. Like that's the level of laziness that we've achieved.
So wait a minute. So if I wanted to be a hitman in New York, I would just bring you. I would bring groceries into your building.
I welcome you with open arms.
And the doorman
on a whole usher number of levels. I would welcome you with open arms.
Yes, yeah. That's fantastic. All right. Now today we actually have. Surprise announcements from Apple, like all kinds of new devices.
Toys. Today's a toy day.
It is a toy day. Which one do you want to talk about first? Let's talk about the least interesting one first.
The Mac Mini.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's just a really bad lame update. It's still the 8th gen chips on there. I guess they're a teeny weeny bit faster, but it's kind of lame. It's still 6 core and
I don't even think I don't think they're even faster. I think it's this is the same processors, right? But new storage options.
Is that the only, at least I don't remember. Was the old one 128 gigabyte the least you could buy, and now it's up to 256 maybe?
Yeah, maybe even 64 gigs was the least you could buy. I forget.
Oh, God, that's crazy. It's just so insulting.
The Mac Mini has never been my favorite.
It wasn't bad when the last update, because it went up to 6 cores, which is a pretty substantial.
You were right. So now it does start at 256 for storage, 256 gigs for storage, and it did used to start at 128 gigs.
The max RAM is now 64 gigabytes instead of 32, which is nice.
Yeah, 64 gigs works. I've got 64 gigs in my 2019 iMac, and I know what do you have, like 52 terabytes
in my MacBook, my 16-inch MacBook, I have 64 gigs, which is fine. And
fine.
And I on my Mac Pro, I only have 96 gigs. I had 128 gigs in my last Mac Pro, and I got nowhere near using it, so I just use 96, because in the Mac Pro you want to have 6 sticks to get the max memory bandwidth. So the next step up from that would have been like 192 gigs of RAM, which would have just been
ridiculous. Do they have to
ridiculously
match? Can you do 2 and or can you no, do 4 you, and 2?
Yeah, they need to match if you want max speed, correct?
Okay. Did you see
they don't have to match just to work, but if you want the best throughput, yeah, they need to be matched.
Did you see that Apple also released the Afterburner module?
Yeah, separately. I'm sure for those that do ProRes editing, it's great, and I don't care.
I just figured you'd get it because you could. how are you not getting it? How are you not poised over the buy button right now?
I'm not getting any of their video cards either. They're all overpriced or dopey for my use. I'm sure for other folks that they might be a little bit more value. Yeah, actually, that is one of the few cards that if you happen to be in the sweet spot, the throughput of it is pretty massive. So if you do nothing but ProRes editing, it seems like a no-brainer to get that, but I don't do ProRes. I do a little 4K editing here and there. It's so little that it's laughable. So I really don't.
Okay, but if we ever resurrect Pot.0, our video podcast that we haven't done an episode of for a while, surely you would get the Afterburner card for that.
Why would we do that in ProRes? That would be insane. Because we have web cameras.
Because you can. How many things have you done that you didn't need to do when it comes to technology?
Well, so you know,
I haven't known you for years.
So that's all true. I can't deny any of that. But here's the question is, what stupid justification do I find for making, you know, for getting it? Because there's always some stupid rationalization, and it's not just because, which might be, you know, plenty of reason in many cases, but I could see it. Like if we did enough video that we actually edit it, and let's be honest, we never edited it at that point. We just threw that thing straight to the web and we're done. But if we actually edited it and it was slow with whatever H.264 or 265 in kind of editing and rastering, and I could do it faster just by doing it to ProRes, even though it would be overkill, I could see totally doing it then. But for what I understand is ProRes is only faster on the decode. It does no encoding. So I'm not sure even for that application, would it work for us? It's only like when you're editing multiple 8K streams, right? That the decode side would do it. Although it has an FPGA, so that chipset could be reprogrammed. And apparently there was, in the release of that card, they released that at some point for the Red One series of cameras, the 8K, I guess, or whatever, they're going to update the FPGA so it can also decode that format. So if it ever could encode, then I might actually be tempted.
You know, I read for so Andrew wrote this. I read this sentence right here. It also lets you play back up to 6 streams of 8K footage at the same time at almost 30 frames per second in Final Cut Pro 10. And I just don't understand why you don't already have 4 of these. Please tell the class how many displays you have.
I only have 6.
Exactly. All right.
We've gone down a rabbit hole. Nothing to do with this Mac Mini. Anyway, the Mac Mini is very meh, right? Going back to one of your good points is, even a meh update is better than no update, because at least you're not buying a 2-year-old machine for new money, right? For current value. They've done the de minimis update. So at least now if you're buying one, you're getting whatever the most current
Mac Mini. It's a little bit better. I'll take, you know what? Right. I will take that over 6 years without an update.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, so okay.
Yeah,
we'll give them a pat on the hat.
We'll give them a pat on. Yeah, for sure. And 256 gigs as a starting point is way less insulting than 128, which is beyond useless.
I kept insulting everyone with the $899 deals. And I guess this will be a natural segue into the MacBook Air that were going on. And they were selling them $899 with the 128 gigabytes. Even, you know, grandma's probably a bad example because she has some photos, right? Like 3 photos and your 128 gig drive is full at that point. So it's just an insulting machine. There's nobody on earth that isn't going to throw that machine out, you know, in less than a year, because it's just garbage. If at that point you're using it like a Chromebook, in which case save yourself some money and just get a Chromebook for $200 instead of, you know, $900 for the MacBook Air with 128 gigs of storage. After you install the OS, there's what, 80?
Yeah, 80 but so now it's $799 for 256 gigs.
Are you sure it's $799? I thought it was $999.
$799 for the Air. I'm sorry, I'm still on the Mac Mini.
Oh, Oh, Mac Mini. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Right, right. I thought we'd left the Mac Mini. But yes, you get 256 instead of 128. And also, as well, on the MacBook Air, it's now up to 256 instead of the insulting 128.
Yeah, and you're right. It's $999.
$899 for EDU, which is actually a pretty darn good deal. Although, I think this gets back to a little bit of tongue-in-cheek that we were talking about the other day. But I actually, the more I think about it, the more true it is. It's people that get very low spec machines are being selfish and wasteful, and they hate the earth and want it to die, because 128 gig MacBook Air, you're throwing it in the garbage like in a year, and nobody wants it. Nobody wants that machine after a while because it's just so limited. So you want to get these machines with in somewhere in the sweet spot where you could see that. Why wouldn't you use the three to five years from now, or be able to give it to your kid 3 to 5 years from now and still get another year or two use out of it? And in that regard, the Air update is the biggest update, I think, to their portable line, to the ultra portable line that Apple's had since the original, because it goes up to quad core, and two cores, I think, for a modern operating system is just a joke today. It's just the machine is always slogging, always pinned, even for normal menial tasks. Once you go up to four core for a machine that weighs this little and is this small, that is actually very usable as an ultra portable. And it's the first time that the Air or anything kind of in this 11, 12 inch super 2 poundish, 2.5 poundish weight has been four core, at least with a Mac. So I think it's a huge update if you bump it up to the four core level, but you know, that costs a lot more. It's $1,300 to get the four core i5. And then Apple kind of very smartly prices this. It's another $150 to bring it up to an i7, which gives you four more threads, right? Which really gives you a lot of bandwidth. So once you get around the $1,400-$1,500 level, there's a lot of machine that you get with the Air. And I gotta wonder if, like, you're not wanting to sell your Air to get this Air because it's just so much more bandwidth for you to really work on.
Well, so in our morning meeting today, morning for me, afternoon for Dave, since he's on the East Coast, but he noted that it seems like this update reintroduces confusion between the low-end MacBook Pro and the high-end MacBook Air. And I think it does reintroduce that confusion. I don't know if that's necessarily a bad thing. I know that when Apple updated the MacBook Pro, the current MacBook Pro that came out at some point in 2019, and I immediately said, and still believe, that I would have bought the 13-inch MacBook Pro instead of the 13-inch MacBook Air. Now, I'm not sure which I would get. I'd have to really think about the 13-inch MacBook Air with the Core i7 versus the 13-inch MacBook Pro.
So I wouldn't get the 13-inch MacBook Pro, period, because you know it's going to be replaced by a 14-inch like any month now, right? It's not far off.
Take that out of it, though. Look at what we have today.
Even then, like the max processor you can get with the MacBook Air is a 1.2 gigahertz quad core, right? i7 versus you're at like 2.8 or something for the quad core on the 13-inch MacBook
Pro.
On the Pro, sorry. Yeah. So even there's a lot of headroom. There's more ports. I think if you're at all like serious doing real video work or something like that, you're going to get the Pro. And this is just a really healthy entry level ultra light. If you really want the lightweight thing, I think to me, the storage is, and I get why they probably limited it for the very reason you mentioned, because I bet you the 13/14-inch MacBook Pro is going to have up to 4 terabytes of storage instead of the 2 limited on here. But for most people, 2 is plenty.
For most people, 1 is plenty. For ordinary folks.
I don't think that's correct. I think if you have anyone that stores any photos on their machine at all, the 1 terabyte is usable, but you're eating a good portion of it. especially like grandma or whatever, like those, you know, Words photos and stuff, all my kind of aunts and whatnot. They have a bajillion photos of everyone.
So what I found with the 2018 MacBook Air, which is what I have, more than enough to go write fiction in a coffee shop. Way more than enough for that. But taking it on a trip where I've got to work, right, where I've got to work out of, you know, while traveling, I was pegging it all the time. And I got it with max RAM, which was 16, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was constantly pegged when I was on that machine, when I'm doing, you know, all my day job stuff. And a big part of that simply being that I just have so many tabs and so many browser windows and tabs open.
But you're not a particularly heavy, I mean, you're writing, right? Like, I don't mean to demean it, but like, as far as CPU grunt, you're looking at a lot of web pages and using Word or not even Word. You're using some editor. It's probably more lightweight than Word. And so that's not
which job?
For kind of your writing for the, you know, Mac Observer.
For TMO, well, you know, I've got Photoshop going. I've got browsers open. Oh, okay. And I've got a crap ton of tabs open, and that ends up chewing through the memory and also ends up, like I said, you know, it can peg my CPU when I've got everything else going too.
Right.
On the MacBook Air, that is.
Yeah. So I think the sweet spot of this Air, unfortunately, is still decently pricey, which is you want to go up to the i7, you want to get the 16 gigs of RAM, and you probably want to go up to 1 terabyte, which is the sweet spot for most people, and it's only $200 more. But yeah, all that up, and it's $1,850. But for $1,850, you got a super ultra portable, real powerful machine. You wouldn't want to do Photoshop on it 24 hours a day. But on the other hand, I bet you if you're on the road and you need to rip a little Photoshop on that here and there, you're fine with that. I think it's a very
keep, sweet keep in mind my day job. Update. My day job Photoshop work is manipulating relatively small images. It's not
right.
It's not working on big images and doing photo editing. It's more like I'm prepping images for articles, which may involve layers and attempts at humor, but is not like, you know, adjusting the gamut on a, you know, 24 megapixel image or something like that.
Right. And that's where, like, if you're doing a lot of Photoshop, a lot of photo editing or video stuff that's heavy, you're going to want to go up to a MacBook Pro at that point, just but I think it's the most solid update to this class of machine Apple has done in a super long time. To get.
I agree.
This is one of those clear cut, get it if you can afford it. The 1850 level machine with 16 gigs of RAM, the i7 and the 1 terabyte of storage is kind of a great power performance balance. In the context of Apple pricing, right?
Right. It also has the keyboard that's on the 16-inch MacBook Pro.
Yeah, they've gone all to the all switch, the old switch, not the butterfly.
The butterflies are gone.
Yep, the scissors. Nice solid update. I'm curious if you're going to talk your way into one at some point.
I want a new iPad Pro.
Great segue. That's the next new product they did.
I don't have any road trips planned. If I had some heavy travel planned, and you know, coronavirus is pretty much nuking the travel plans that I did have for the summer, at least at this point. But if I was planning on doing a lot of traveling and I needed to work, I would probably want to take a different machine.
Well, and this gets into a good segue, because along with the new iPad Pro, which is kind of an underwhelming update over the last 2018 iPad Pro, in that the CPU doesn't seem to be that big of a boost. It has like one extra graphics core than the A12X. It's the A12Z processor.
Yeah, they didn't do the 13X, which is what they usually do, right? The iPhone gets the... gets
well, the, usually you the, get the A13, you get the next iteration of the iPhone, so it would be the A13, and then you get the A13X variant for the iPad.
For the iPad, yeah. And this time around, the iPhone 11 has got the A13. The 2018 iPhone iPad Pro has the A12X.
Right.
But then the 2020 iPad Pro has got the A12Z.
Right.
And we don't yet know exactly what that entails other than having an extra GPU core.
And the Apple touts that it, you can run it harder, longer without throttling more, as much. So it may, maybe it has a better thermal, you know, fingerprint. But the bigger, there's only two big things in this iPad. The iPad itself is looks, you know, it's got an extra camera, which the ultra wide camera, in addition to the normal camera on there, which I don't care about. Some people might, but it has the LiDAR camera, so it can, you know, use like laser imaging to detect harder surfaces. And that's apparently useful for augmented reality and who knows what else.
Depth detection, right?
Yeah. And the biggest thing to me is the new keyboard that it comes with. It's got like this almost Mac Pro type stand mount keyboard, into which one at the hinge, there's a clever USB-C port, which is kind of cool. But more importantly than that, it has a scissor switch keyboard in there with a trackpad. And by adding the trackpad in there, they've basically made this into a mini little laptop. And the more that you add trackpad type features to this, all of a sudden this starts to really get more serious as a laptop replacement for more tasks. And it might be all the computer that a lot of people need.
It is, I'd even put that a little bit differently. It is increasingly the only computer that some people need.
I think that's
probably been the case for some folks for a while. I think that Apple is making that more the case now. The biggest hang up, look, all right. So support for trackpad input directly on its own keyboard, let alone the way this keyboard seems to work and allow you to better tilt the device, the screen, to suit you. Those things are fantastic, and those things are definitely an improvement, especially for people who, you know, like want to use this thing to write, because sometimes you need to move around your cursor.
Way easier to manipulate in and around text with a trackpad than it is with your finger or the pencil, for sure.
I completely agree with that, and that then means that the biggest shortcoming for iPad Pro, in terms of it being a true computer replacement, remains access to the file system.
And I think a menuing system too. I think you're going to start to see some pressure to have some kind of unified menuing system. A lot of apps mimic this. Instead of having the menu bar per se up top, they have a few of common icons, like a gear for settings, you know, a trash, a share thing. Mm-hmm. You start seeing a lot of similarity in those things, and you start to wonder at some point, do you just do the right thing and put a menu bar up there for some common tasks, particularly when you've got it, you could see that maybe that disappears when you don't have it docked into the keyboard with the trackpad. And when you do,
yeah,
it could be something that appears. And then some windowing. All of a sudden, maybe you can have some detachable windows once you have a trackpad in there. Who knows? But for now, I think the mouse support exists in the current, well, the previous version, because 13.4 just was released today as well. A whole bunch of software updates have come out for the iPad, the iPhone, and I think the watch and the TV.
Possibly TV, yeah, but not Mac as of this speaking.
Right, which really needs it the most, because although Catalina is getting better, it's still maybe one of the worst releases of the operating system, buggy-wise, that they've had in a long time. But I digress. Yeah, you could see it, more and more pressure. Apple has given in to pressure. Like this chorus for getting mouse support has been going on for quite a while. They very recently put it in. It's kind of a stinky implementation before 13.4, and we'll see how it is there. And you don't have like a cursor. You don't have an arrow like you do on the Mac. You have basically a see-through representation of your finger spot that moves around, and then that turns into a text insertion point when you're over text. So they're trying to make it different. And also when you're moving the finger halo around, we got to come up with a name for a finger spot. I don't know what a finger cursor representative. Do you have a whatever?
I don't have a name for it.
Yeah, it kind of snaps. It doesn't, like when you get to something that is button-esque, it kind of snaps to that spot for you when you move it. So you don't have to move it quite all the way and it snaps to a selection thing. Some people really hate that. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. I guess time will tell, and we'll see how the usability works out on it. But it is not the same as just sitting at your laptop. It is a different experience with the trackpad there. So we'll see how it pans out. But yeah, it seems to the iPad is giving way a little bit to the Mac and adopting some of its tried and true feature sets to make it more productive in more ways. And, you know, you wonder if this isn't a slow morphing, right? That it adopts enough of the features that at some point do they stop making the Mac because it's adopted enough?
Not yet. Not yet, man. Okay. The Apple's designers and engineers still need Max to make the iPads.
I agree, and I hope that's the case for a while, but you certainly see some progression of this, at least potentially.
You do, and you also, you know, one of the things that I've talked about a few times is that we haven't heard Tim Cook denigrate the toaster fridge in years. And I've said that probably indicates the Apple working on a toaster fridge, and I think that we're seeing more and more of that as we speak. This is an example of Apple trying to do the toaster fridge right.
And this, the flip version of this, of how would the toaster fridge look on the Mac, there was a patent recently released, and it's almost as good as the idea that I've been harboring for a long time, which is instead of the patent shows kind of a MacBook and where we have our giant touchpad now, instead of just a giant touchpad, that area is basically a screen, like a little mini iPad, right, in there. And it works as a touchpad for when you're just kind of keyboarding and using the Mac, but it also has secondary screen information, so you could do like mini iPad-y type things there. I think the smarter idea is, instead of just using that for a trackpad area, is make the entire palm rest of the MacBook all screen. So in essence, you have a decently sized kind of iPad second window in there, and it solves the big problem that Apple has always been pointing out, whereas you don't want to put your hand up to a screen that's standing vertically, you know, away from you, because your arm will get tired moving around in the air that way. But if your hands are already on the, you know, on the palm rest there, as long as you have good palm rejection, you could very naturally do some hand manipulation for things that work better with hand manipulation, and kind of have the best of both worlds on a Mac that way, without having to make the vertical screen touch screen enabled by having that whole bottom panel touch screen enabled. Of course, it's just a patent, so it doesn't mean they'll ever make a real product out of it, but kind of interesting that came out as well, which again shows some of this toaster frigification of some of their products, at least are things they're thinking about actively.
Yeah. I agree with everything you just said. And again, I think that the fact that Tim Cook hasn't denigrated, although let me ask you this, I've been touting that notion for a while, but at the same time, Tim hasn't been asked about toaster fridges. So is it that he has stopped denigrating it, or is that he has stopped reacting to people asking by denigration?
And he doesn't.
I think it's the former, but I don't know.
When was the last time any Apple executive had a tough interview? Come on, seriously.
Well, we do still sometimes get stupid question. Well, we often get stupid questions asked during the conference calls, the analyst quarterly conference.
Well, isn't that awful that it's like during the financial disclosures that you might get a hard question, and nowhere else in the tech press do these guys ever do a hard interview? And when they do get some executive there, it's all puff questions. It's all a joke.
Yeah, it is always. Yeah, this is
it's
true.
It's a joke. The tech press has been delinquent on so many levels. I'm not going to get into a screed about it because I need a show that's rated X.
It was interviews. It was interviews and the analyst conference calls where the denigration of toaster fridges happened, and we haven't had that in a long time. But again, is it because he stopped, or is it because he stopped being asked?
Yeah, there's so many other bigger issues for the financial analyst to ask about that I don't think that's reaching the top 10, you know?
Yeah,
like here's a question. How come you haven't diversified your production?
You're going to go down a rabbit hole. Let's not go
down that
rabbit
hole. Yeah, let's not go there.
Let's not go down that rabbit hole. Instead, let me tell you all about our sponsor this week, ExpressVPN. So we all know how a VPN protects your privacy and security online, right? But you could also use a VPN to unlock movies and shows that are only available in other countries. And let's face it, right now, there's a lot of people who are at home, stuck at home, watching TV and movies and looking for more stuff to watch. ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think you're located. You can choose from almost 100 different countries. So just think about all the Netflix libraries that you can go through. You love anime? Use ExpressVPN to access Japanese Netflix and be spirited away. But it's not just Netflix. ExpressVPN works with any streaming service, Hulu, BBC iPlayer, YouTube, you name it. There are hundreds of VPNs out there. But ExpressVPN is ridiculously fast. There's never any buffering or lag, and you can stream in HD no problem. ExpressVPN is also compatible with all your devices, phones, media consoles, smart TVs, more, whatever. So you can watch what you want on the go or on the big screen wherever you are. If you visit my special link right now, expressvpn.com/ACM, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and protect yourself at expressvpn.com/ACM. One more time, that's expressvpn.com/ACM. And I want to thank ExpressVPN very much for sponsoring this week's show. All right, John, we have you wanted to do something for topic two.
Topic two, we can try to knock it out quick, which is with these super powerful ARM processors that had just come out in the new iPad that are more powerful, at least Apple touting, more powerful than many laptops. How likely and when might we see the transition to ARM Macs?
Oh, that little question.
Yeah. I think we could kill this topic pretty quickly, though. I think... you and I had different bets, and I've at least proven more right than you on which would be the first machine to have an ARM processor, although maybe not. There's still potential that you could be right, which was, will they release, if they do release an ARM Mac, will it come out on the low end, kind of like in a MacBook,
right,
or on the high end, kind of in a Mac Pro area? And both are plausible.
Don't you think we would have seen that happen with the MacBook Pro? Excuse me, the Mac Pro, if that was going to be the case?
So I think, to be fair, I've seen recently, like, I think 80 core, dual chip, 80 core ARM processors in kind of server farm areas, mm-hmm. Which are, that's a lot, right? You got 40 core ARM chips that are going nuts on there. So there definitely is a high end with ARM, but it's just not near as high end as you can get with kind of Intel AMD line. There are four chip 64 core machines you could put together. So was that
But Apple isn't doing that. So no, but compare what Apple is doing to what's available on ARM.
Well, the point is the headroom, right? Like you're still competing at the high end with what? And the delta between ARM on the low end is higher than the Delta on the high end. If anything, there is no Delta. It's less than, the ARMs are not still up to the same level as the Intel and AMD chips on the high end. They arguably have far surpassed what is going on the low end. Even this 4-core 10th gen thing that we just put, Intel chip that's in the new MacBook, the new iPad has an 8-core chip in it, right? It's already, you know, destroying.
Yeah, with an 8-core GPU too.
Right, right. So, like, without trying to compete in the desktop market, they're already arguably exceeding what's available in the low end. So, to me, it makes sense because they could come out with a great desktop chip, right? It has a much higher thermal level that it can take. They could put out a 12-core, right, or 16-core ARM that will decimate what's in the MacBook Air. And so they can just say, look, we're giving you 2x, 3x the performance. No one's going to, you know, have an issue with that. Whereas you're going to get into arguments. Is this 20-core ARM as good as this 64-core AMD?
Right. Like, so you're saying that you got to, that Apple has a better path starting off at the low end, say the MacBook or MacBook Air.
Right.
And essentially proving performance via the low end, not to mention, right, of course, giving developers time to make the transition.
Right.
Right. And then, sort of expanding upward. That is a path I could see.
And also, people need to remember that on the Mac Pro side, a lot of people do virtualization things, and that requires an Intel chip, or you need an ARM chip that is so much more powerful, right, to virtualize at the same speed that would be an Intel chip, that you're talking orders of magnitude more speed, and I don't think that exists.
But there is a version of Windows that runs on ARM.
Sure, but people do, they need to virtualize things that are not going to be optimized for that yet,
right.
That are Intel based, and so that's still an issue at the very higher end of this tech. So it gives time for that. But who knows? Like this is the first time that the Apple processor team has slowed down. We're so used to every release being like double or more the performance of the previous. It's kind of scary. Mm-hmm. And it has to slow down at some point, right? And apparently this is the point where the performance delta, we won't know until there's benchmarks and stuff like that, but the performance delta from the previous to this version is not nearly as big as the last jump. So I don't know what that means. Maybe we're kind of reaching the end for the lower end, these guys haven't even tried to do a desktop processor. I just wonder what they could do.
I'm sure they've tried. Oh, I'm sure they've been working on it.
Yes, I take it back. I'm sure they have kind of research and development on it, but they really haven't done it. And there's a big difference between,
And there's surely a version of macOS that's running on ARM too.
Yeah, that's trivial. People always make, like, ever since Next, like, this whole point of the transition is trivial. Like, it's an extra checkbox to,
And Apple has proven that it can do that.
Yeah, it's, that part's, I mean, I don't want to make it, it's not trivial, like, oh, do I want to pick between a latte and a cappuccino today, trivial. But on the scale of some of the harder things that Apple has done, it's not amongst the hardest.
So why do you think, coming back to the iPad Pro, why?
By the way, I ordered mine. I got the 12-inch. I got the new one.
The 12.9-inch, right?
Yeah, the 12.9.
Why do you think you got the keyboard too?
You can't order the keyboard. It's not available to May. Okay. So it wasn't available to order, but I will be getting the keyboard for it. It looks super. It's obscene. It's called the Magic Keyboard, which is kind of confusing because their normal keyboard is the Magic Keyboard. Listen, but
right here, you hear this? You can't hear that, but here, you hear that? That's the Magic keyboard on my Mac. Why would they do that? Why would they do that? Why would they do that? Why would they call it the same thing? Why would they do that?
Know. Or at least the Magic iPad keyboard or something. I don't know. I don't know. But it's only $350.
Yeah.
But to be fair, they have like 1/3 of the Mac Pro hinge in there for the stand. So, you know, bargain.
It is insanely expensive from the isolated abstract concept of keyboard.
Right.
It's probably not expensive from the standpoint of what it includes, which is both the trackpad and that hinge and the connector. And then there is a bunch of stuff going in that.
Yeah, they probably should have priced it $50 less, but whatever. Whatever. It exists, so there's
We'll see what it's priced at when it actually ships. If there's enough pushback and if there's a lack of interest or enough criticism, it probably will be cheaper. But here's the thing. Here's the question. Why do we not have the 13X processor? Why is it the 12Z?
Yeah, I don't know. It would have been weird for the first time for the iPad to introduce a new chip line.
The 13 is an iPhone 11. The A13.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
There's an A13 in that. Oh.
Let me make sure I'm telling you the truth.
No, I thought it was the A12.
iPhone 11 Pro processor. It's the A13. So this should be if we follow past
the 13X. So this is even more befuddling. You're absolutely right. Holy moly. Yeah. That is weird. So it should 12, be trailing
12Z. I mean, there 13. Is a difference that we know of. A difference that we know of is one more GPU core. It was seven GPU cores, which always seemed weird to me, in the 12X. And it's 8 GPU cores in the 12Z. What we don't know is how much faster they run. We don't know if the iPad Pro has more or the same RAM as its predecessor. And we don't know if the neural network engine thingy in it is beefier. We don't know that either. We don't know if it's running at a higher clock speed.
Yeah, this is what's interesting. So the A13 has two high performance chips and four efficiency chips. So it's a 6-core and not an 8-core. I don't know. Yeah, this is kind of confused.
The 12X had 4 and 4, right?
Yes.
Efficiency cores and 4 high performance cores.
Right.
And it appears that the 12Z is doing the same thing.
Yeah. That is really interesting. And the A12 also had 2 high performance and 4 high efficiency cores. It didn't. I think the 13 introduced a lot of the AI stuff, which they're also touting is in the A12Z.
The 12Z does have the neural. So why not call?
I don't get it. Yeah, that is a weird naming choice. A very weird naming choice.
Clearly, although I reserve the right to be utterly wrong, clearly the 12Z is a beefed up A12 processor variant. It's not an A13 processor variant.
Yeah. And both are 7-nanometer. Yeah, I don't know. This is very confusing.
And it's naming. 6 months later too, right? I mean, this is the A13 shipped 6 months ago.
Yeah.
And when we saw the 13X, or excuse me, the 12X and the 12, I think that came relatively close on. I mean, yeah, I honestly don't get it.
It's very confused naming. I wish, to be fair, it was a press release, so there's no one that could question them yet, but you would think this would be hopefully one of the first questions they could use to disambiguate what the reasoning is for this.
Yeah. Do you really think that's going to happen?
This is the kind of thing that someone's going to get. I don't know. Don't get me into a cynical mode. Yes. Let me play Brian. Of course, someone will find out.
Wow. This is weird. These things ship tomorrow, right? You're going to have yours tomorrow?
It said the 25th is when
that's not tomorrow. It's next week.
Is when I should have it. And I think that's the first day it's available.
Yeah, that is. I'm wrong. So once people actually have their hands on these things and can do benchmarks, and it's conceivable that these have already gone out to some reviewers.
Oh, you know, all the YouTubers have them.
Probably, right? So once we see some benchmarks, that'll probably be when people start asking questions. That will inform the questions is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, it's true. If they're still like 30% faster, even though it's the same variant, maybe nobody cares.
Yeah, and I wonder what it's going to do for the... It's interesting. I mean, the iPad Pro already had fantastic graphics capabilities, so it's interesting that they added another GPU core.
The 2018 12-inch I have is liquidy, just buttery, beautifully quick. They're one of the... Never have I been on there and saying, boy, I wish this was faster. It is like crazy fast. So, and the good news, by the way, is the new keyboard with the trackpad will work on the 2018 model as well.
Right.
So if you have one, so you don't need to upgrade just to get the keyboard working, if that's what you're interested in.
Do you think anything interesting is going to come out of the LiDAR sensor?
To me, maybe outside of Apple. Meaning you and I've been having a very snarky conversation, one-sided conversation that you ignore, but I don't mind that you ignore it. Tell me that any day you're going to send me that list of awesome AR programs that you use daily, which is a sum total of zero.
Because AR is a big bagel. That is not
bagel.
The point. It is that is useless, not useless, the useless. Point.
Someday it might be useful. I agree with that, but that day is not today.
Okay, well, then I accept your apology.
No, whatever. You could use your banal cliches. They don't change the fact that it's useless. And this is adding to the useless pile, making it even more.
You know what AR needs, John? AR needs
goggles,
glasses.
Yes,
it needs something at the end of our nose that we can look through.
And we both vehemently are agreeing past one another that it'll be life changing once you get some specs that are somehow usable. Right?
Honestly, I didn't realize that you thought that. I thought that this entire time you've been arguing that AR is useless and will continue to be useless.
Yes, on the phone it will continue to be useless, absolutely useless. Once you get to something that you can wear or is actually, you know where it might be the first, and I had this in one of my previous cars, the heads-up display. If they used AR on a heads-up display in a car, that's a perfect application to do some really cool stuff just with GPS.
Yeah, for sure.
Take this right away.
Okay, we are not just vehemently agreeing with each other. We are exactly in lockstep, because this is exactly what I've been saying. The notion that Apple is planning on a future where we walk around with our phones held up in front of our face is nonsense.
Yeah, it's useless. And all the AR hype that they keep coming, like new games or whatever, even the games aren't interesting with AR. It's on the phone. The sensor in and of itself makes AR more accurate, because LiDAR generally, and I'm not going to pretend to be a super LiDAR expert, I'm far from it, but it generally works with hard surfaces. So that's one of the bad reasons you don't, Elon Musk is known for being very anti-LiDAR. He's like, it does not solve a lot of the problems. You need to use real cameras, because you can shoot through a bag of meat and not necessarily see the bag of meat well. And unfortunately, it's really important to see the bags of meat, because people tend to take offense when you run them over with your car.
You're referring, of course, to autonomous vehicles, just to,
right,
just to clarify.
Right. So he's a big proponent against LiDAR, because he kind of views it as a bag of hurt, like it's a dead-end technology. But what I wonder is, and it, traditionally, LiDAR has been very expensive technology. That's one of the problems. And if Apple has done something in creating or helping to create a sensor, a LiDAR sensor, that is dirt cheap enough to be in a phone, you get this very democratizing effect, like all of smartphones did. They made this bundle of sensors like accelerometers and GPS things and whatnot that used to be super expensive and made them super cheap. Now you wonder if in technologies like Tesla, all of a sudden, when they were thinking of very expensive LiDAR solutions, could they use like 20 of these iPhone quality LiDAR sensors around the car to do something that's good enough? Right, that it helps enhance things with regard to LiDAR. So I think it's almost more exciting outside the iPhone in what might be done with a cheap LiDAR sensor than necessarily with the iPhone, because on the phone itself, I don't see any terribly useful AR apps. There's not one that's compelling enough for me to run for more than one time as a novelty.
Right, a couple things. First of all, it's not on the phone. It's on the iPad Pro.
I'm sorry. So yes, you're right, on the iPad.
And secondly, though, what do you think people can do with it on the iPad Pro? So along with this sensor, Apple is adding to ARKit a scene geometry API. So basically an API that will handle the data from this sensor and give it to developers so that they can use it.
Yeah, I think what it's going to do is, if you've ever used any AR apps like the IKEA app or whatnot, and you try to place things, and it does a really good job, but it's doing this visually, right? So you see drift a little bit here, yeah, a little bit there. And what you have with LiDAR is, again, it, for hard points, not for, you know, watery bags of meat, but like for the corners of your room, the corners of your desk, it is going to be much more exact. So the placement of AR objects on there should be a lot more solid, and there should be less drift. And as you move, it will sense the geometry of your shift better, because those hard angles are going to come in a lot more accurately than kind of the neural nets can with just the photography that it's bringing in.
All right. So what do you think? Is this an experiment or is this a first step? Because I think those are two very different things.
So think about this with regard to glasses. The fact that they got this on a teeny tiny, and I keep talking about this on the phone because the rumors are that the new iPhone 12 is going to have this LiDAR as well. But once you get this chip down this small, all of a sudden putting that into a set of glasses becomes much more plausible. Yeah, right?
It senses stuff up to 5 meters away. I don't know how useful that is for glasses.
5 meters is a pretty good space.
Driving or walking down the street.
No, this is why maybe for Elon Musk says, you know, for driving, you need probably like 200, 300 feet out, and it needs a different kind of sensor array. But in and around your house for augmented reality?
In and around your house for sure. But outdoors, like less sure.
What's the size of an average like bedroom or
inside den? The house, you're right. No, yeah. there is zero doubt about it. But outside the house, there is zero doubt that that's not going to be particularly effective. And I think that AR's potential is bigger outside the house than it is inside the house.
Well, let me put it this way. Even if you could only map out, say, with decent accuracy, 15 feet out, the projection that gives you for the rest of the imagery makes the rest of the imagery more accurate, too. Right? Because you're using it for axes. Like, this is demarking the first 15 feet of the road. Well, the rest of the image that seems to go along with this, you know, is easier now to calculate.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
So it's not a, you know, an ultimate solution, but it's improving things. And I don't know, have there been any other phones or iPads type devices that have been this small with LiDAR in them? It's the first one I know of.
No, nothing. Apple's so far... I mean, assuming anything actually comes out of this, Apple is so far of everybody else. It's not even a competition at this point.
But from the grandma or normal end user perspective, I don't think there's much of this feature. Like, no. Maybe for photography, it helps because it's going to give you better depth and sense of space of how to, you know,
that's possible.
Process some things. But it's not a big improvement, even though it's a really big technological hurdle that they jump through to get this thing done. I think the bigger payoffs are like, I guess you and I have both been saying, which is at some point this needs to be in some kind of glasses.
Yeah. All right. So we have just time enough for our last topic, John.
Okay. Shoot.
Oak Island. I love Oak Island, man.
Spoiler alert.
I think we talked about it last time, too, but I don't care. For those that
hate Oak Island, we're sorry. And
just cut to the end of the show. Yeah, you're done. Fast forward, you're done, and we get it. However, John and I love The Curse of Oak Island, love the mystery,
One of the things that I'll tell folks is, if you cannot stand the, this is one of those things we were talking about offline. There are authors that we can't stand the way they write, but we love the stories that they tell. And apparently Isaac Asimov is that way for me. Like he writes like a soap opera is written, but the actual storylines are really cool. So I suffer it. In Oak Island, it's kind of like that. For every action that is new, which is minimal per episode, I mean, you have to go in with the lowest of expectations. Like we found a new piece of wood, right? That's a big finding for maybe an episode. They will describe that piece of wood and how it was found from 87 different perspectives and say the same thing 87 times just to make sure you understand that they found a new piece of wood.
But they're doing less of that because they're finding more and more stuff per episode. And this is despite the fact that there are more and more episodes per season.
This is coming from someone with Stockholm syndrome that has watched this show for many, many years. So for you, this rate of increase is very substantial. For someone that is just coming to the show fresh, they're like, I've seen this explanation 37 times in the last 2 minutes.
Stockholm syndrome for yes. the show. Could it be that this person has watched the show too many times?
All right, that's one of the 87 explanations of what just happened, right? Now, that has happened 86 more times. So if you go into the show and you're giving it a chance, you have to understand that for whatever reason, they have to stretch this material out. So there's kind of that goes over and over and over again. But that said, the mystery of this place is just really wacky. And the findings this episode were super cool. I'm wondering what you were most, spoiler alert, we're going to be giving away.
We're going to be talking about stuff. And this is the show called, To Boulderly Go. Do you see what they did there? that aired on March 17th, the day before we recorded this episode. This could be a rabbit hole. Let's try not to go into it. I am flabbergasted by their ability to not complain about the regulatory limitations placed on them by bodies.
Oh my.
And don't get me wrong, it's very smart for them not to be bitching about that on TV. Right?
Why they couldn't get an extension to keep that copper dam after they found so much stuff in there that's never been found before. And let me get this straight. So Canada thinks it's a smart idea after uncovering amazing structures that are like 400 years old. They're worried about some dude's house from 100 years old, the foundation, which is useless garbage, maintaining that. But they found stuff that's 400 years old, and their solution is, yeah, just put piles of dirt back onto it and let the water just go over it. That's awesome. Let's just do that.
So what John's talking about is the fact that there's a cofferdam that was built last season and then extended this season that in an area called Smith's Cove. And what the point being, of course, to hold back the water in Smith's Cove so that they could see what is underneath the ground so they could actually work on it. And apparently that permit ran out after about a year and by
2 years. They've been working on the copper dam for 2 years.
Two seasons. That's not necessarily 2 years.
Well, all right.
But whatever. So they could get an extension, and we don't know why they couldn't get an extension. They did not talk about why they couldn't get an extension. They did not talk about why it is that it was important to let Smith's Cove go back to the way it was. And one of the things that they were showing, and if the show is to be believed in this particular regard, which is never anything you should take for granted, right up until the last day, they were digging and they found a lot of man placed and, you know, constructed wood structures deep under the ground in Smith's Cove.
And let me give some context to it. It's basically somewhere on this island they think is a big treasure, right? Maybe it's the Holy Grail. Maybe it's the Ark of the Covenant. People have all kinds of different theories of what is down this place that the Knights Templar might have brought down. Nobody knows. But one thing that was not proven up until this season, and we're talking over 200 years of people doing treasure hunt searches, is that it's all booby-trapped. And one of the booby traps is basically a water trap that pulls water out from the ocean through this island that someone built, that if someone gets too close to the treasure, it floods. So these flood channels have been rumored to exist. They have proven decisively for the first time ever. There's photographs of the one of the five of the water traps, the inlets for it, that they took,
is what they call it.
The box drains. And on top of it, they found four or five other structures around the box drains that no one knew existed, that and that they've dated decisively to 1769 and perhaps earlier, that are beyond mysterious how they could possibly be built. You know, there should be a tie-in with, and I think there was, with Ancient Aliens. Like, how the heck did they do this in 1769?
They weren't putting a cofferdam.
No, but
back in 1769.
But in an area that's underwater.
That's what I mean. How they hold back the water enough to build stuff underground, underwater. It's crazy. And
there's a concrete wall there, and nobody knows what its age is or what its purpose is.
I would bet a lot of money that the concrete wall is just a searcher construct.
Maybe. So, but the point is, there's so many crazy and provably ancient, by relative standards for North America, structures in there that you would think that a society designed to preserve, you know, things, a heritage society that gives permits for this kind of stuff, would want to preserve those. And the solution is the permit's over, dump dirt on it, and let the ocean swallow it. Which, and the fact you're right, like, these people are saints for not complaining about it.
They may well have complained about it. They're not complaining about it.
Well, at least
on TV.
Not on camera, right? Yeah.
And it's kind of, I mean, because I know that there are some aspects of the permitting system that they respect from the standpoint of not doing what I think the Forestall crew did, which was just bulldozing and
blowing everything up.
Yeah. And like, they believe in preserving some archaeological aspects, but at its heart, this is a salvage job. It's not an archaeological job.
Yeah. I mean, this is a scenario where the pendulum swung one way too crazy to let's blow everything up to now let's, you know, the foundation of a house that they have pictures of from 100 years ago. I'm like, really, 100-year-old house? This is something we care about?
It's 200 years.
All right, whatever. Yeah, the point being is it's a known, there's nothing mysterious about this house. They found a, you know, knife in it or something, and that was like supposed to be something I care about.
A knife?
Anyway.
Under the foundations?
You're going to kill me with that because it's sadly too accurate. Anyway, what were the bigger, I don't think that was the biggest thing. Nothing in Smith's Cove
tunnel,
was big.
It was the rocks and the tunnel.
The tunnel
in Smith's Cove.
That was off Smith's Cove. That was what they assume connects with the box drain in Smith's Cove and goes all the way, but they're somewhere in the middle,
the main flood tunnel is what
that
is
they could finally block off, which is huge.
So one of the things they didn't show, John, was exactly how they filled that in. They showed nothing of how that stuff was filled in.
You almost wonder if they don't just shove one of the coffers, you know, spikes right in the middle of that thing just to block it off and be done with it.
Well, I would assume these guys seem to be very, very smart. They apparently have an inordinate amount of money, some of which is coming from the TV show.
Right.
Right. And some of it is probably, I'm sure a crap ton is coming from outside investors, quote unquote. But if I was in their shoes, I would cover it up in a way that I could uncover again.
Yeah, you hope. So one, the fact that they found that middle, I don't know if it's actually in the middle, but middle-ish section of what they perceive to be the main flood tunnel is immense. Because one, you could hopefully, it helps them triangulate, right, towards what is the money pit, which is where they think all the treasure is, and also stop the booby trap from booby trapping and flooding things. But then they found that that extra big rock in the swamp, and it was of the size of the five rocks that form Nolan's Cross.
Yes.
But it's kind of, it didn't have any obvious relationship. Mm-mm. So, like, I was trying to, like, draw lines from Nolan's Cross to see, like, does it is it some kind of smart attachment to it? And nothing jumped out at me, at least initially. I don't know if you saw any.
Mm-mm. I did not. Yeah. The only thing I saw was that it was at the tip of the swamp.
Right. Which is kind of interesting. They always, I got to give them credit because I don't think they foresaw this, but on a lot of the earlier, way, way earlier seasons, they always put the, what do you call the on the dollar, the pyramid with the all-seeing eye on top of it. They always overlaid it. And it turns out, like, weirdly, there is a circle of rocks right at the tip where the eye would be.
Yep.
Which is either they knew this like years ago and they were just lining this up, or it's kind of a spooky coincidence that what they were lining up actually panned out to look like that, which is a very much, what do you call those? Not the Templars, the Masons, right? A Freemason kind of imagery. And the Masons are supposedly the kind of like the descendants of the Templars. So the notion is that these symbols are somehow supposed to be clues for Templar type folks to help find the treasure.
Yeah, but that doesn't make any sense because from the standpoint of it, these things are being found with modern means. And when they were built, the means to find them again would not have existed. So I don't believe that they're placed there as clues. That does not make logical sense to me.
I wonder if some of these things were more visible at different times. Like,
that's,
you know, with,
certainly possible.
You know, it's if this stuff was built in the 1760s or so, that's yeah, that's a good number of years for things to kind of shift and move around.
Go ahead.
That all this stuff is weird stuff that they're finding in the swamp is I think they've provided a lot of evidence this season that the swamp is artificial. Yes. Or it's man helped form the swamp to cover stuff. And I think that has become more definitive. That it used to be wild speculation for that. And I don't think it's that crazy a wild speculation anymore.
It's
not definitive, but no, it's not as crazy.
The question is why was it built? For instance,
To cover a ship that they blew up, supposedly.
Yeah, but you'll note that they haven't talked about that much this season. And I think that was hot speculation in the show, in the course of the show. That was hot speculation last season. And this season, they haven't found anything like that, and they really haven't talked a lot about it either.
Well, they found the spikes that are the types of spikes that would be used for planking in a ship. But they haven't found any shipboards, at least definitive shipboards, in the area that...
And I don't... Do you remember the big shipboard they found when they first started messing around in the ship's plank? When they first started messing around in the swamp seasons, many seasons ago? Do you remember that?
Yeah, I vaguely do.
Yeah, I don't know that we ever saw anything about dating.
Oh, that's interesting.
On that
plank.
And is that because the dating showed that it was like, you know, 60 years old?
Well, there's also a lot of survey spikes around that area. And so it's one of the tough things with this mystery is there's been so many people doing searches and treasure hunts, and they've introduced so much clutter and garbage into there, meaning with searcher shafts that use that the wood isn't 300 years old. It's only 220 years old. So it's actually not part of the original thing. And they constantly have to date this stuff to see, you know, is this someone that was searching for the treasure or is this part of the original treasure stuff? And only the stuff that's around 700, in the 1750s, 1770s era are things that they believe are from the original depositors of what might be a treasure. And everything kind of beyond that is very questionable what its origin is. So that complicates things, right? When they find them there, it could have just been people 100 years after this thing went in mucking about looking for treasure.
True. All true. And or, you know, at least all reasonably speculated. I am most interested in all of these wooden structures deep under the ground and deep under Smith's Cove. That it just boggles my mind. I don't understand even how it was done.
so great. It's a lot of crazy engineering that's just hard to explain. One other thing, though, although my explanation is the cynical view is that people were trying to build kind of a settlement here, kind of half did it and then went away and gave up. Could explain a lot of it, but not necessarily all of it. But what they've kind of been quiet the last bunch of episodes, and I wonder if they're not saving
record
it.
Of that, though, John. That's nah, the thing.
Not necessarily. Not back then. I mean, there might be, but it's equally plausible there isn't. So I don't find that as dispositive one way or the other. But one thing that's kind of gone quiet is they've been getting, they found a searcher tunnel that they knew was one of the oldest searcher tunnels that was very within 14 feet of what is supposed to be the money pit, which is the hole that goes Chef to five. The treasure. And they kept nibbling at this shaft, finding its orientation, where the corners were. And they kind of stopped for the last few episodes. And I wonder if they're saving that for the finale. And I don't know how many more episodes this season are there. I'm guessing maybe.
I think that was episode 13. And, you know, this used to be an 8 or 10 episode season show once upon a time. So it's greatly expanded.
So I got a feeling what the cliffhanger is going to be this season is they're going to definitely get something into the money pit itself and say, that's it, we found it. And then we're probably going to have to wait till next season to see what do they find in the money pit. That's my guess.
You say that. I think if they actually found any, the way you pitch that, it's like you think they're going to artificially hold back what they found.
No, but I mean, if they actually got to, you know, they've been trying, I don't know how long it took them to triangulate in real time because this show's very disjoint from a timeline perspective of what we see. They might have spent the whole season finally getting to it and kind of saying, even with that searcher shaft, they dug what, like over five or six holes to try to figure out its orientation. So meaning just because you get one line in towards the end of the season that says, yeah, I think this is the money pit, doesn't mean you know what the bounds of the money pit are or how you should go about getting into it, right? So they might have gotten towards the end of the season and said, well, at least we found it, we can mark it, and next year is our big dig into the money pit itself. Well,
and we know that they're bringing in the big 8-foot caissons.
Right.
I'm assuming that's going to be for the money pit.
Oh, you think so? Oh, that's interesting. That makes sense. That makes total sense.
It would either be that or redigging shaft five, but it seems
and
like
an 8-foot hole is, remember the 5-foot one that they put in, was it last season, I guess?
Yeah.
I feel, a
while back, but go ahead.
The diver they sent in, I mean, talk about claustrophobic in that thing. It was very tight. With an 8-foot gap there, you can do some comfortable looking if you send a diver down there to if they get that far.
Yeah, but
so it's exciting on a number of levels.
Okay, let's assume that there actually is something, right? And that this isn't a wild goose chase.
The Ark of the Covenant.
What if the caisson
like, smushes what, it?
No, oh. Or smushes or more worse, it's a foot outside the caisson.
Well,
I mean, because remember they found the cavity, the cavern that was underground.
But that wasn't part of the money pit.
It wasn't the money pit itself.
Yeah. So you would think what would make some sense is if you're piling treasure, it's not just like one item. They didn't just put the Holy Grail and nothing else in there. You would think that there's, or maybe they did, who knows? But there would be other stuff there, and you're picking up some debris, right? Like some coins, some, I don't know, whatever, stuff. And once you find any of it, then, you know, you're slowly broadening your search out with time. But yeah, you know, they always find little parts, little leather and parchment pieces. And yep. One of the theories is the original works of Shakespeare are down there, right? And yeah, if you're sending a giant metal caisson digging into the work, yeah, there's nothing left of that, right? It's just all destroyed.
Yeah.
If you tear into it, so
the caisson that when they were digging and they were pushing the caisson down, and then they encountered something that was hard, and then it gave way.
Right.
Right.
They presume they pushed what was it, like a chamber downward.
Yeah.
Is what they
said. Like a large casket or some kind of stone or cement structure. That thing was probably destroyed. And who knows what all other kinds of destruction have occurred.
All right. It's their job to find it, and then great restoration experts will have a puzzle to mend that thing over time, I guess.
Very much enjoying the season, though. This last episode, To Boulderly Go, was very interesting. The stuff that they're finding underground is just fascinating to me.
Yeah, this is a relative scale. If you're, again, you have to like a mystery and a very slow moving mystery. The best thing, though, about this show is what I tell people is do not bother to watch any past episodes. It's a waste of time. If you watch this show even for like 7 episodes, within 7 episodes, you will see almost every factoid you ever need.
That's true.
Because they repeat it all the time.
You can pick up the show. Well, but there is an aspect. There is an aspect of the search. There's an aspect of getting to know everybody that would be interesting to some and uninteresting to others.
True. If you really like slow moving stuff, you can look back, and there are kids that kind of died along the way of some of the searchers.
Yeah, I hate how they keep emphasizing that with the, you know, the legend has
wasn't curse related. Yeah.
Yeah. That's like, they've never once sourced that legend. I really hate that part.
Mean, they clearly did that initially to get this.
The thing that they're saying that I'm taking objection to is that legend has it. Six people have died in the search, and legend has it that 7 must die before anything is found. That's nonsense. They've never sourced that legend. As far as I'm concerned, the legend comes from the show's producers.
I think there's a decent chance of that. By the way, did you notice that they thought that the tablet at 90 foot down in the money pit, that supposedly it might be behind some lady's bush, because it was like moved from the bookstore where it sat for years or whatever.
Yeah, but
they were going to get a permit to look under the bush.
They did.
Did they? Yeah. I didn't see. So they found nothing, I take it?
Nothing.
Oh, okay. All right.
Nothing there.
All right. Well, that answers that.
That is, yeah,
one sad. Dead bush later.
it's a large bush. Okay, John, we are over. Thank you for everybody for going through our little tale. And we very much, I appreciate you being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And as a reminder, if you will go to expressvpn.com/ACM, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. Support the show, watch what you want, and protect yourself at expressvpn.com/ACM. And on that happy note, that is this week's Apple Context Machine. If you have anything to comment on, add, or question, write me at acm@macobserver.com. Our bandwidth is provided by CacheFly. The bass is by Boom, recorded just for TMO. Again, John, thank you.
And thank you.
And that's all for this week.